Hi, everyone. It's Gustavo, the host of the Enabled Disabled podcast. It is my great pleasure to welcome Jeff Rubin to the show. I was on Jeff's podcast a few months ago called Unconditional Healing, and we are really excited to have him on the show. Jeff is a Buddhist teacher. He is the founder of Unconditional Healing, where he helps people who are going through chronic illness, disability, some type of difficult life experience to come out of their experience or embrace their experience with more grace, more empathy, and more perseverance. A quick description of myself. I am a middle-aged Latin American male. I have dark brown hair combed to the front. I am in my living room where you can see a little bit of some drapes and some blinds, and I am wearing a black polo shirt. Jeff, welcome to the show. Can you give us a brief description of yourself and where you're at?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you for the invitation, Gustavo. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I'm a white male, age 72, and balding, and I live in central New Jersey. I'm wearing a polo shirt that is pink right now, and I'm in my accommodation office, shrine room, and I have a 55-gallon fish tank behind me as well.
I can see the fish tank. It looks really nice. Yeah. So let's get started. Tell us a little bit about growing up. Did you grow up in New Jersey as well?
I did. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, in a blue-collar area of Newark, New Jersey, home of Philip Roth as well. And I went to the same high school as Philip Roth. I grew up a Jewish Hebrew school student, went to a Hebrew school after public school, and both of my folks worked. I had a really idyllic childhood. I really was into basketball, and our high school, as it turned out, had the number one team in the country. Actually, we went 37-1 for junior, senior years, and five of the kids made the pros, actually. So I had no chance of playing on that team, but I did play on an A team, and we actually won a national championship in my senior year. It was filled with going to school and playing ball constantly. Had a lot of friends in the neighborhood, and you don't see that all that much anymore. People are a lot more isolated than we were. I walked to school, I walked back to school. I don't see that all that much anymore. So I grew up in a really idyllic environment, and I'm very grateful for that. And that's not always the case today.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of sports you could have played. Was it just you were in a basketball city and that was the thing to do, and your high school was already so good anyways, you were drawn to basketball?
There's a couple of things there. We also played touch football constantly in the street. And when a car would come, we would pull aside. And then we would also go to a park to play. But parents would not let me play high school football. I really would have loved to have tried. I don't know if I was good enough, but I was pretty fast and shifty. Who knows? But that was out of the question. I ended up playing soccer for the high school. I was a goalie. I didn't like contact, and I was a goalie for 4 years, and that was fun. I got kicked in the head a couple of times. Who knows whether that still resonates or not? And then I just started playing ball, and I was a big pro basketball fan. The Boston Celtics were my guys, and not the Knicks, which was the New York team. And I just started playing. My dad put up a hoop in the driveway, and I was out there rain or shine constantly. And then making the Y team and, yeah, going on from there. And played with a lot of lifelong friends who I still relate with today.
That's incredible. That's a great story. I know this is not the easiest question to answer, but when you were playing and you were just loving the game, what do you think it helped you? How did it help you develop? How did it help you mature, grow, deal with people? Or was it something that you just played because it was fun to play and you loved it and you were good at it?
Yeah, I don't think there was much thinking about what I was doing at that stage of my life. I was really kind of sheltered from those kind of questions until much later in life. Right there, I didn't understand how I was privileged living in that environment, and I had no real cognizance of the outside world. My high school was diverse, so I got to relate with people from different cities, backgrounds, and other countries, and their races especially. And there was no real issues in my environment, so nothing really pressed upon me to question what was going on until matured a little bit later. Well, that's a really great question. And I have thought about that, how sheltered I was and how oblivious I was about the outside world and politics, especially. No idea.
And what started to, did college start to change that?
College was a mind-blowing situation for me. And I'd never been on my own. And I had never, I would say never drank. I drank a couple of parties. But my parents owned a liquor store, and there was liquor constantly in our house. And I never was drawn to it. I didn't know about drugs at all. I was sheltered from that. And then I went to college. I went to Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. And that was a kind of a rude awakening. I had gotten by in high school. I wasn't a great studier, but I had gotten by on my own inherent smarts. And I was able to do well in school without putting in a whole lot of effort. And then, boom, that really changed in college and university. I had a very difficult, intense curriculum that I had chosen. I thought I was going to be a veterinarian, so I had a lot of sciences and biology, and I retained my same study habits. I was going out and shooting pool and drinking beer, first time on my own, and I almost got on probation, graduation, grade probation my freshman year. I didn't. And then late in my freshman year, I discovered a psychology class, and that really resonated with me and carried me through the rest of my schooling, because that really interested me. I wanted to study that. But the other thing was, I went to school in the early 70s. And when the country was going through massive upheaval, culture and politics and Vietnam War, I thought I might be drafted. We had a draft back then, and there was a lottery system where you were, they picked your birthday out of a hat and gave you a number. And my number, fortunately for me, came too high to be drafted. But I was also, by sophomore year, I was getting heavily into drugs and the whole countercultural thing, letting my hair grow long, listening to rock music constantly. And I was able to at least get involved in studying a little bit more, and I was able to manage that part. But the world was changing, and I had no idea what I was going to do after school. Not a clue. I was really groundless in protesting the war and all that countercultural stuff. I wasn't quite a hippie, but I was getting pretty close.
As I'm sure a lot of the students at that time were who had some passion and some awareness and were being gripped by all the things that were happening. Yeah. How did
Absolutely. And my sheltering lifestyle was torn away. I was very aware of what was going on and that my life was in danger if I was drafted. That's a wake-up call if there ever was one. But at that time, I told you that I was interested in psychology. My major became experimental psychology. But I was really frustrated because the classes I was taking were solely revolving around the brain, the human brain, and studying that as if that was the essence of consciousness where it originated. But I wanted to study the mind and being and what it means to be a human being, and we weren't covering any of that. And so I started reading Far Eastern literature. I read everything I could on Buddhism and Zen and Hinduism and Sufism, all the mystic religions, even the Kabbalah and Judaism, which is a mystic tradition. So I was really getting ensconced in that, and I began to meditate on my own. And me and my roommate addressed my psych professor about whether we could do a, what do they call it, independent study. It's called back then, if we can manufacture our own class and study meditation with him, meet a couple of times a week to meditate together and meditate on our own, and then write a paper at the end about our experience. And he went for it. And I laugh now because think about designing your own class when we did that, and I began to meditate, and that really set up the seed of my meeting a teacher when I got out of school.
So through this experience, you were drawn to it. You were looking for something different. But you said you had no idea what you wanted to do out of school. So how did you navigate those waters? What brought you to, what was your first career path, or what did you do after?
I traveled around and took odd jobs. I still had no idea what I wanted to do. I took jobs like I joined the post office, and they were thrilled to get me, being a college grad, and that was unusual. Had to take the civil service exam, and I quit there. And within 2 months, when I realized that I couldn't get a route, they were shuffling me all over on working early mornings and then late at night and come in the next morning, and you were taking other people's route, or not even other people's route. I want a route. There'll be a drop box in the middle where the carrier will go and replenish their mail bag. I wouldn't be the guy that would take the truck and drive out there and fill the mid-route collection box. I was told I was never going to get a route for at least 5 years, and I ended up quitting. I'm not doing this. I went down to Washington, D.C. area and stayed with a friend and did a substitute teaching for a while in Fairfax, Virginia. And then after a couple of years, and I had a high school girlfriend who stayed in touch with each other through college, even though we didn't go to the same schools, and ended up coming home and getting married. And that was about the time that I quit the post office. So I got married, and I wasn't even employed at that. Fortunately, my wife was, and she put up with me for a while. And then she actually found an ad in the newspaper that Bell Labs was looking for psychologists or people who had studied experimental psychology. And I went there and I interviewed, and it was very intimidating. But I ended up getting a job as a contractor to start. And ended up working there and learned a lot about what was then called human factors, is now called user experience or usability, or it has to do with making technology easy to use and easy to learn. And we conducted a lot of field tests and lab tests with end users and bringing them in to try prototypes of products early on. And we learned interface design as well and heuristic principles that can be applied to any interface. All that good stuff I learned there and ended up getting hired full-time. And then I moved to AT&T where I learned how to teach public classes for AT&T. It was all one system. There was all one belt system. They hadn't split yet. And I would go out and teach courses to the baby bells, they were called, the individual companies in a state. And I would teach them human factors work and documentation work, how to write a user manual properly. And I learned a lot about all that stuff and ended up eventually going into business myself in a few years forward from that.
That's really, I had no idea. That's really interesting. How, I'm assuming that the field tests, were you looking for a certain type of person to do those field tests? Did you want, or was there like a mix of older population, younger people? Did anybody with any kind of disability factor into the user experience? What was that? What was the population like?
That's a great question. I would say absolutely not. We're not including the disabled population at all. It was the typical end user. If it was when I was working in the Bell system, of course, it would be a Bell system employee who were mostly white and male. And that would be the people we would recruit for tests. When I went on my own to do this work, of course, I was entering various industries. It wasn't just Bell telephone work. And we would recruit the typical end user that the product manager would tell us pointing the product for. And more often than not, there were specialty industry professionals who would recruit for you. So we would outsource that. And they would find the people that the product manager had identified. Now, at that point, the culture was evolving, and we would look for a more diverse population. But I can't say that we actually look for disabled folks.
And that's really interesting, because it's one of those things that I think there's so much there to explore and figure out, because it seems like there are these preconceived notions in your product design, right? Like, we want to target these end users who we think are our target, and we're automatically removing a bunch of people from that equation who could make Absolutely. The product or the experience so much better. So we're just perpetuating this cycle of a lack of inclusion.
And that's exactly what's happening with a technology like face recognition. Whereas they don't recognize black faces all that well, because a lot of the developers are white, and that's an inherent bias is being built into the technology. It's amazing how that happens, but it's real. Never mind disabled folks.
But I know you transitioned into becoming a Buddhist teacher and working on this unconditional healing project. Have you thought about, or did you think about, helping companies design or consult with having different types of people in mind, like bringing in maybe some people with different disabilities to help design and improve a product?
The transition to unconditional healing wasn't on my own choosing, so to speak. Yes, I became a Buddhist. I'll backtrack, and I'll say that I mentioned my Far Eastern studies interest, and I began to meditate on my own. And then about 2 or 3 years after graduation, 2 years, 73, I met a teacher, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who had emigrated from there when the Chinese came in and completely destroyed their culture. And I was really drawn to this person because he was talking about experiences that I had read about but hadn't experienced it. These experiences of Buddha nature or an unconditional healthiness or unconditional wisdom, which is inherent in human beings. And this guy actually manifested it. So I was really drawn to him, and that's how I got into the study of Buddhism per se, more formally, with his guidance and a whole community formed around him internationally. His name was, and he's written a whole bunch of books. He's long deceased, but that was the beginning of my study. And then gradually by 1980, I had become a teacher. I had become experienced enough to teach others meditation and Buddhist Dharma as well. But it wasn't until I became ill that the whole unconditional healing program really formed. And we can talk about that if you like.
I would love to. I would love to, but I have a couple of other questions.
Absolutely.
Sure. So you said he manifested, your teacher manifested these aspects of unconditional connectedness, well-being. Can you talk a little bit about what did that look like to you? What did that feel like? Was it something pretty, as soon as you met him, it just something, what was that experience like to meet somebody like?
I'll tell you what it was like meeting him. I was really intimidated. I first met him, or didn't meet him, I first saw him at a public talk in New York City he was giving. And then I went to a center that had formed in a brownstone in New York City called Dharma Datu. And when I went there, his students were saying, you have to sing an interview with him. I said, I have nothing to say. I'm a little schmuck. What do I know? But I finally got up the nerve, and I went into a room where he was sitting, and there was a cushion in front of him at his feet. I sat down on the cushion. I didn't say anything for 5 minutes. I was so intimidated and tongue-tied. And finally, he said, what's up? And that broke the ice, and I asked him a couple of inane questions. But the description of what it was like looking into a mirror, because there was no ego there. There was just a reflection who you were, and that was what was so intimidating. It was like this person was able to see through your being, and it was very exposing, like being naked in a room, even though you had full clothes on. And it was like that experience, and as scared as I was really drawn to that. Wow, this is an unusual person. I really have to learn more. So it was very visceral. It wasn't conceptual. It was like being blown away in a way.
And let's differentiate that. I like the way you described it. It was like looking at a mirror. So it wasn't judgmental. There was no shame. There was
no
negative emotions. It was just like he was reflecting back to you his full, like just who he wasn't.
And who you were. And that it was very claustrophobic in a way, because you were seeing all your neurosis all of a sudden. And all your neurotic tendencies were coming out, and you were sort of tongue-tied being in the presence of this person. Now, that shifted, obviously. That shifted over time as you worked together and went to programs with this person and other interviews and interactions with them. But that first experience was like nothing I'd ever experienced with any other person before.
Was there anything about the way he carried himself physically or his eyes?
It was so, so mindful. Every motion was artful in a way. Would that be affectatious, if that's the word? It wasn't intentional. It was just who he was and the way he picked up a glass to drink and very mindful and put it down, very mindful. Everything was like that. It was very skillful, artful, if that's the way to describe it. It's hard to describe without being there, but his very presence was something that stood out to you. Without him saying just that sense of being who you are fully and 100%. And as a unrealized human being, I know how I sort of hide my characteristics or pretend to be something with one person and then another person, very much affected by the environment. And he wasn't that way at all.
How did that shift over time as you got to know him more personally?
Well, I was doing a lot of practice. And for example, in 79, he was conducting these 3-month programs at major hotels, oftentimes being renovated so the organization could get a good deal on being able to afford something like that. And of course, we paid to attend that. My wife and I and our 15-month-old son went to a program in 1979. It was called the Vajradhatu Seminary. And it was a series of 10-day where all you did was meditate and sitting and walking meditation. And because we had a kid, there was childcare set up where we all rotated and watched other kids while the other could go practice. And then 10 days of study, Buddhist Dharma, and he would give talks and his more senior students would conduct classes during the day. And we would alternate that. And that went on for 3 months. And that was a life-changing experience for me. I mentioned that I was a pseudo hippie or for a hippie. I wasn't completely off the reservation. I was still working. I still had a family and kids, but I was inclined to not really be into working, livelihood, that aspect. And then I came back from there. I was aged 30. And that was a breakthrough experience for me. I came back to AT&T. I started wearing a tie, which I hadn't been doing. And I really buckled down and got serious about my livelihood. Ended up taking a position with a small consulting firm where I learned even more about consulting and how to run a business. And ended up going into business for myself after that. That experience, your question had to do with how did that change? Well, being around him so often for those 3 months, I was seeing him every day. If not personally, then I was seeing him in a talk or a situation like that where you could ask questions. And it really, the inherent neurosis started to wear out from practicing and being in that atmosphere for so long. You're becoming processed, not intentionally, but you're just in that environment where your body and mind are starting to relax and not be so uptight.
You would think that I think some people would think that going to a Buddhist retreat for 3 months like that, the reaction afterwards wouldn't be, let me get serious and advance my career, but do the opposite.
That's the kind of dissonance. You're exactly right. I think it would be the opposite, but he was teaching that you can't escape. You're not going into a cave like the monks did years ago. You live in America, and your work is your practice. Absolutely. And so there was no difference between the secular and the religious, you know, and I love that. I love that approach because I didn't have to change my entire life. I could get into my life deeper and further and through that, become more awakened, more transformed without having to go into a cave or become something I was not.
I love that line. Your work is your practice.
Yeah. Yeah. He was teaching that your mindfulness is 24/7. It just doesn't happen when you're sitting on the cushion. Then you have post-meditation and you're aware when you're speaking to someone and when you're listening to someone, and your meditation is really a 24/7. It's constantly on. And when it's not on, then you notice the difference between when you're mindful and when you're non-mindful. And that's an important distinction, which you don't have to have shame about. If your neurosis is very evident, you don't have to have shame about that. It's your working basis. You're working with who you are always and not pretending you're something you're not.
It's really interesting. That's deep. I'm assuming the more you practice, the more mindful or aware you are of when you lose that mindfulness. But is that something that really only comes through practice, because you have to get used to or process what being mindful actually means to you?
Yes. And meditation practice is a neutral practice. You're not trying to attain some state of mind that's in the future or that's not there. You're noticing and allowing to arise whatever wants to arise. And then you simply have a technique for noticing that and then coming back to the breath. So in shamatha meditation, which is roughly translated as peaceful abiding, you identify completely with the breath. I'm going to be very careful of how I describe it, because you're not watching it, you're feeling it. You're feeling it, the breath from the inside out. You're becoming the breath wholly, fully. And then you notice you're distracted. So when you're distracted, you notice that, you say thinking, and your mind's here, and you come back to the breath. That's the basic technique. And meditation is completely neutral because you're not trying to filter out anything like we normally do with our thought process. That's acceptable feeling. Not an angry person, so I'm going to know that I am angry. I'm a peaceful guy. And then all of a sudden you blow up like crazy on this tantrum because you're repressing that. Well, in meditation, you're allowing whatever feelings want to arise, and you're allowing them to come up, but you're not indulging them. You're not pushing them away, but you're not encouraging them either. You're right in the middle, noticing, observing, and coming back to the technique.
How is that? So as somebody who meditates, I'm gonna take away my knowledge for a second and just ask a question that I think could be interesting. How does it different from some of these journaling practices where I'm going to spend 15 minutes journaling my thoughts, not judging them, just putting out what I'm feeling, what I'm going through on paper, and then I'm just going to leave them be and maybe I'll read them later, or I'm going to go for a swim and just let whatever thoughts come up in my head or in my mind come up in my mind and they're just going to pass? What are some of the differences.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because there's a million ways to practice the Dharma, and not just on the cushion. And that could be your main practice, your formal practice. But I recommend journaling to a lot of folks that I work with. Journaling is a way to get your thoughts out in front of you on paper and notice them without being attached to them. And the very important thing you mentioned there was you're not editing. You're not editing. You're just letting whatever wants to come out, come out. And that's very similar to formal meditation, where you're letting whatever arises, wants to arise, arise. So it's very similar. And swimming is a form of meditation, as long as you're mindful of each stroke, hitting the water, and then pushing the water back behind you, and the legs kicking, and all that good stuff, rather than thinking about what you're going to do for lunch. It becomes mindful practice when you're there fully, and if you're not there, it's something else, but you're still swimming.
Interesting. How do you encourage people who maybe don't have an interest in meditation, or think, you hear, so meditation has become much more, let's say, trendy or popular in vogue today than it was 30 years ago. So how do you separate some of that noise about you'll improve your focus, you'll improve your energy, you're going to feel like all of these claims that you can just Google and read about, all these different reasons? How do you actually help people come to this practice in a way that is going to have a more long-lasting impact on their lives?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is I don't make any guarantees. Just like my teacher made no guarantees. He said, you're going to find out for yourself by practicing. I'm not here to offer any carrots in front of you. And there's no stick either. You could say in the Zen there is a stick, because that's a part of the shrine room protocol, is they actually, but you're asking for that. You're asking to be woken up when you're falling asleep. That's not cruel and unusual. But I try to see, I meet people where they are. And if they say, I'm a person, Jeff, who can't meditate, my mind is always going a mile a minute, I can't sit still, and I'll say to them, can you sit still to watch a TV program? Yeah, but that's entertaining. Okay, how about you try 5 minutes? Can you do 5 minutes? And go ahead and do that and try to sit for 5 minutes 3 or 4 times a week, and then let's meet again. And then we'll talk about the experience and what was going on in your mind. And I never noticed that. My mind has always been, I really never noticed that, because I never sat down and looked at my own mind. And that's a way to get started, not making promises, maybe dipping a toe into the water, and 5 minutes of quality mindfulness practice is better than an hour of sitting there and distracting yourself for the full hour, as long as you're at least attempting to be fully there. That's the beginning step.
I like that. I think it's interesting when you read a lot of these books, especially the Zen books, and they emphasize a lot of proper posture and how you should be sitting, how you should be placing your hands, your feet, your legs, being aware of everything. It's a little bit, I guess maybe the practice of it, my question is for you, was there a rigor to the physical form where maybe it turned off or did not include people who have disabilities or who can't sit in a certain way or some kind of condition? Have you seen that change over time? Has that become more accepting, or was it always accepting in your experience and the books were just something else?
Let me think back to when I was first getting strong, and there was a points of posture that were encouraged, and I'm telling you, it was so painful sitting for that long a time. We would sit maybe up to 45 minutes before we would do walking meditation, and then sit down again and do it again. And your body is screaming at you. You're allowed to shift your posture. It wasn't that strict as Zen is in the approach that I grew up in. But we saw people in wheelchairs sitting, and people who had difficulty sitting on a cushion or sitting in a chair or a wheelchair. And there was never an early issue with that. It wasn't that rigorous that you had to maintain it for the full time, or it was a goal. And you need some base that you're aiming for, at least. You can't just flop down and sit any way you want. We didn't have people with sticks, but in the early days, and there was what was called, and the Omse would come around, and if you were asleep, I'd gently shake you. And if you were in a slump posture, they would gently, with your permission, try to correct your posture. Now, we're not talking about someone who can't get into that posture. I'm talking about a normal spine situation. If you were disabled, then that was a whole different situation. But what was mind-blowing, people, when I first started teaching the unconditional healing weekends, is it really was come as you are, because I was attracting people who were disabled, who were sick, who were undergoing cancer and chemotherapy and were exhausted. And I allowed them to lay down in the shrine room. And that was never before seen, that you were allowed to do that. And that really was a monumental way to attract people to the program. Because they would tell others, of course you're feeling sick and you're feeling nauseous, but they have a room you can rest in during their program. And if you're on meds, they have a refrigerator where you can bring your meds and store them. And in sending that up, I was really, from my own experience of being disabled, I was really tuned into that, of course, and was letting people be as they were able to do. And just showing up was the real key. Just show up. We don't care how you come. Come as you are. And that's great.
That's beautiful, Jeff. That's powerful. You have a great episode on one of your podcasts about the difference between pain and suffering. I want to dive into a little bit, because I think it's really important for people who are listening to this to gain a deeper appreciation of that difference, and how what you teach and what you help people with is so beneficial with that. Can you tell us a little bit about how you define those two things and why they're different?
Sure. And I'm glad you asked, because that's an essential crucible of the whole program. And we're all trying to achieve understanding that. So I talk about two kinds of suffering. And the first one I call pain. And pain I'm differentiating from the second as being inherent and unavoidable in human beings. We're all going to suffer pain. And I'm not just talking about physical pain. I'm talking about emotional pain, mental anguish, distraughtness, losing a loved one. That's going to happen. We're all going to eventually get sick, even if some of us are lucky enough not to get sick for a long time. Others are going to get sick when they're kids and are disabled, as you were born into a situation where you're inherently disabled from the get-go. So that's painful. It's painful emotionally, living in that atmosphere and feeling stigmatized and isolated. That's painful. That's going to happen. But how you relate to it That's where the suffering comes in. Is it a calamity? Is it like, woe is me, or why me? And that attitude makes things worse. It's more painful. It's a pain on pain. So suffering is how we relate mentally, emotionally, spiritually to the pain that we're experiencing. And in unconditional healing, we work a lot on, through mindfulness practice, noticing we're adding to the situation that doesn't have to be there. How our negative talk, especially, how we talk to ourselves in our mind's ear, what we say to ourselves, you're worthless, you're a piece of shit, you should kill yourself in some extreme cases. And we're talking about that as those are just thoughts. They're just thoughts and they're just emotions. They're workable. You can't change the first one. You got sick. Okay, that's real. Or you're disabled. That's real. But how you work with it, that's what we're going to work on together.
All right. So for example, I've had some nagging physical injuries on my journey towards getting stronger and fitter again, and they come and go every few months, and it's very easy to get frustrated, to get down on myself, to say, look, am I ever going to get to a point where there's not something? Am I ever going to be able to just feel healthy and strong, or just not, you know, where it's not, where something's not there all the time? It can be, it's very easy to become emotionally drained and to become, for the frustration levels to mount up and up and up because of those things. Yeah. And that's what you're talking about, is rather than just working through, okay, there's a hip strain here, let's deal with that. Let's work through it. Let's feel that. Don't pile more crap on top of that experience.
Yep.
Through all of those manifestations of our self-talk.
Yep, yep. And it always starts with a little thought, a little shift occurs. And through mindfulness practice, you can notice the little thoughts before they become a maelstrom. And you're basically out of control. You're going to lose it. You're going to break down. At that point, we've all been there. But and the duration of that freak out can be shorter and shorter through mindfulness practice, through noticing, wait, all of a sudden my thoughts have shifted here. What the hell is going on? One minute I was fine, and then someone says something to me and spiraling out of control. And that's all on me. They shouldn't have said what they said. Well, call me that. But how I relate to it is totally on me. It's their problem.
I don't want to overly romanticize, I think, Buddhism the way I did when I was younger. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's giving superpowers or anything remotely close to that. But at the same time, having that mindfulness in those experiences of pain helps you navigate that, where you can still, for example, you can still do, maybe you can, it depends on the situation, but at the very least, it's going to help you through those situations more quickly. And if you are able to, let's say I'm somebody who has chronic pain. If I learn how to be more mindful, I may be able to, say, work for a couple of hours today because of that mindfulness practice. I may be able to get through or focus better or get through that chemo without so much of the negative emotional consequences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, the blinders are coming off. We're not being romantic here. Life is hard. Life is very hard. And we're admitting that. But we're trying not to make it worse by adding a bias, a sort of a cultural bias, if you will. The culture that is reinforced constantly doesn't look on illness as a neutral thing. It's a personal failing or a disability. Oh, you did something, it's your karma. and that nonsense. And we're trying not to adopt the cultural biases in our own mind. And only through mindfulness, I found, can we do that by noticing that our thought process, that thoughts are thoughts, they're not reality. And when you're driven by your thoughts, you're confusing thought for reality. Oh, I'm seeing this, but you're not actually seeing this, you're just thinking about it. And that's when the meditation practice is really not a mental practice, it's an embodiment practice. You're coming back to the body, and the body is very wise. It always knows what's going on in the moment. And then the thought comes second, but the body senses immediately what's going on. And you notice that when someone says something to you that shocks you, you immediately like freeze. And then maybe then you'll be able to come up with some rational thing to say, but you can't hide that initial. The body reaction is, holy shit, I can't believe they said that. And that's an example. So with the meditation practice, we're trying to come back to the body as our home base and live there as much as we can instead of in our head, where we all live, we all spend much, much too much time in our head.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And there's a lot that we can talk about there. I hope we can bring you back for some more episodes because it's really enlightening. But the question that I have for you, I just wanted to touch on that word unconditional, right? So that the meditation is that letting go of all of the cultural biases, all of the family stuff, the societal stuff, the personal stuff. It's stripping those layers away over time. This is not something that happens in a month or 3 months. It's a process that it's a practice. You're practicing to do that and to see those things for what they are.
And you're practicing having no intention to change. That's the beauty of it. And that is the opposite of what we're taught. We're always taught to improve and change and grow. And with meditation, you're sitting down and you're saying, I don't know who I am. Let's see. Let's see what arises. And let's see what's there. And the Zen folks call it don't know mind. Don't know mind. Like you don't know who you are. And you come to that with beginner's mind. That's another phrase from Zen. Beginner's mind means even if you're a 40-year plus student like myself, every time you sit, it's the first time. It's fresh, like baked bread. It's fresh out of the oven. You're coming to that experience. And it is fresh. Every moment is new. It's, you've never lived this before. And we get caught up in our thought, our mind stream, and we just place a bias on what's going to happen and I'm screwed and all that. It's always a fresh start. And that's what my teacher was teaching. Always a fresh start and take that with every breath. Easy to say, hard to do.
Yep.
Understood.
Yes, it is. I really appreciate the time. Really interesting conversation. Can you please tell us a little bit more and give us specifics? How can people connect with you? What are the ways that they can learn from you? Do you have any classes, any seminars, any one-on-one sessions? How can we connect?
Sure. The best way is taking a look at unconditionalhealing.org, all one very long word, unconditionalhealing.org. That's the website. And you'll find information there about what is unconditional healing altogether. And the podcast separate menu item there. You can see all the podcasts or follow Unconditional Healing with Jeff Ruman on any of the major podcast platforms. Now, I have put on hiatus after 39 episodes because I wanted to take a break for my own health. It was becoming a lot of work. I wanted to do some writing. I want to work more with individual students. I want to spend more time with family and friends now that the pandemic is finally lessening. And so the podcast is on there. But I offer twice a month healing circles, and that'll be on the website as well. And the healing circles are free, and they're a chance for people to come together. A community has formed around this work to come and meditate together. And then I either give a talk or we do an exercise like contemplation together, and people share where they are in a confidential and frank environment where people often say things they've never said before, because they're too intimidated in the outside world. So this is, we're forming a container, even though it's virtual, we're forming a container that people can say, I'm fucking angry and I want to give up. And we talk about that. And you can say things like that in that kind of environment, rather than just pushing aside your anger or pushing aside your fear and saying something you think people want to hear. And I found in the outside world, when I first became ill, I didn't want to be around others who were not ill. I was totally stigmatized and I felt isolated. And this is a way for people of undergoing adversity, as you said in the opening, of all kinds, illness, disability, loss of loved one, loss of livelihood, whatever you can think of that turns your world upside, you can show up and share with others who are willing to listen and witness what you have to say without judgment, without analysis. And then I do personal consultations. The healing circle is free. I do charge for the personal consultations, which are one-on-one Zooms, and I describe in the on the website exactly when it's being offered.
Perfect. Have I last question, Jeff? I really encourage people to connect with you and reach out. And these healing circles sound like something I'm going to do. Have I missed anything in this conversation that you feel is important to mention or talk about?
Yes. And one thing I would add is that we possess, without realizing it, unconditional health is not a thing. That's the interesting thing and why it's so elusive. It doesn't care about circumstances. It's inherent in human beings that it's not even born, it can't die. It's I know I'm being inherently worthy, and body and mind are synchronized, and you're grounded into the earth. And we can always accept that, but it's only can be reached when we stop struggling. That's the ironic part. When you stop trying to be better or change your situation, then unconditional health arises in your being and becomes very obvious, but it's always there. It's always accessible. And that's why I call the program Unconditional Healing, because it's very similar to the notion of Buddha nature or Christ consciousness that they talk about in the other traditions. It's always there and it's always accessible to human beings, but we're so caught up in our thoughts that we don't notice it being there. I've had people who I've spoken to on their deathbed who are unconditionally healthy, even though they were dying of cancer, because they said, I'm happy, I have no regrets, and I'm perfectly content to die right now. And that's amazing. See, my mind blowing, but they're tuning into the unconditional health, even though their body is wasting.
Powerful. And that's not tied to, I guess you can say, the religions or the spiritual practices of the world. may be pointing to that or may not be pointing to that, but this is part of the experience that the Buddhism practice that you've learned is pointing to, is showing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not tied to Buddhism at all. It's just something that is in human consciousness. We live in the relative world where you and I are separate and we're talking to each other, but we're in the absolute world, we're perfectly connected. We're interdependent with each other. And that's the kind of energy, if you will, to put it in more accessible language, because it's really hard to explain what the experience is. You can only point to it, and because it's not a thing, and a thing is impermanent, and this is permanent. It's always there, in a way.
I think there's the Buddhist imagery. I got it through Zen, where it's the difference between pointing at the reflection of the moon in the water versus the actual moon up in the sky.
You got it.
And
you got it. Yeah, you got it. Or trying to explain the experience in words is never the experience.
Powerful. And the mindfulness practice is teaching you or revealing to you how to access that.
Yeah, in a way it is. Because it's neutral and it's not trying to change anything. It's come as you are, and through relaxation, you notice this other state of mind, which is completely obscured normally because our minds are friggin' busy. And one thought after the other, thought after the other thought. But that's where you have to start. Start where you are. You know, my mind is not, after 45 years of practicing, my mind isn't like a placid lake. There's currents of all kinds going on, and I just relax with it, though. My attitude toward it has completely shifted. It's not a bad thing. It just is.
That's fantastic. Let's just leave that beautiful moment the way it is, and thank you so much, Jeff. I really look forward to having you back. We have a lot more things to talk about and learn from you. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the invitation, as I said. And I really love speaking with you and conversing with you and learning from you as well, Gustavo. A real inspiration with how you've handled your life.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.